Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi there, and welcome back to another edition of It Happened in Hollywood. On this week's episode, we have the period drama that led to a real-life steamy affair between John Malkovich and Michelle Pfeiffer. All that and more on It Happened in Hollywood. Hey there, it's your host, Seth Abramovich, senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter, and welcome to a very exciting episode. We have Stephen Frears this week. He is a British director of great renown. He's directed some of my favorite films, including My Beautiful Laundrette, Prick Up Your Ears, The Grifters, and The Queen, which you could say set the stage for The Crown and all the dramatization of the royal family obsession that seems to have taken over the world. But what we are focusing on this week is Dangerous Liaisons, probably his biggest commercial hit, I would say. It was an adaptation of the stage play Les Liaisons Dangereuses, which itself was based on a famous novel from the 1700s, based on a series of letters between two conniving Parisian noble persons. And they take great pleasure in manipulating the people around them through sex and gossip. And it was quite the delicious concoction that Mr. Frears came up with. So, without further ado, let us talk all things Dangerous Liaisons. Stephen Frears, thank you so much, and welcome to It Happened in Hollywood. I am such a huge, huge fan of your work. You're one of my favorite directors.
Thank you very much.
You know, and you're still very much active and creating wonderful things like The Regime, which just premiered on Sunday on HBO with Kate Winslet and Andrea Riseborough, a wonderful political satire set in some Eastern Bloc country, unspecified, I believe.
Yes.
So I encourage everyone to check that out. But if you would humor us, we would like to go backwards to the beginnings of your career. And you did...
It was a long time ago.
It was. The 80s is, for me, is when I first got to know you.
Well, in fact, I met Ushfilm in 1970.
What was your first film?
A film called Gumshoe with Albert Finney. Funny film.
So that was a comedy?
Yes.
It was a studio picture, wasn't it? It was Hollywood.
It was paid for by Columbia, yeah.
Yeah, so you right away had a taste of Hollywood with that. Was it a good experience?
Well, I shot it in England. I mean, Hollywood was just on the phone. Hollywood was within sort of long distance, but to my experience, was always in England.
But they didn't meddle with it, or a lot of people, you know, as soon as they deal with a Hollywood studio, they hate their experience. But it wasn't like that for you.
No, it wasn't like that at all.
But then after that, you did a series of films, independent films, I think, that completely captivated me as a young man.
Yes.
The first being 1985's My Beautiful Laundrette.
Yes.
What an amazing movie.
Well, it was a brilliant script. And I had the great to recognize it as how brilliant it was. And then by good fortune, we got it made.
And it was written by Hanif Qureshi, who's a playwright and a novelist.
Yes.
And of course, it starred Daniel Day-Lewis in one of his earliest roles.
Yes. So we were very lucky. We were sort of introducing people.
And very ahead of its time in that it's sort of a boy from a very conservative Indian family. And then...
Yes. Pakistani.
A Pakistani family. Sorry. And then Daniel Day-Lewis plays a sort of a punk tough guy.
Yes.
But the two of them are school friends and they have an affair and they have sex on the back of this laundromat.
Yes.
Wow. That made a big impression on me as a kid.
Well, it was just a brilliant script. When I look at the film now, I wish I'd been young when I'd seen it. I mean, I was middle-aged. I was in my 40s when I made it.
Was anyone saying to you, like, why are you making this film about these two young gay lovers? Or
no, we made it for television.
Oh, interesting.
And I remember people saying, you know, who's interested in the gay Pakistani laundrette owner? Seemed to be a perfectly reasonable thing to say. And then it turned out to be a big success and turned out to be what everyone had slightly been waiting for, a really nice film about homosexuality. In other words, where the homosexual didn't die or didn't, you know, go to prison or something terrible like that.
And it wasn't a gay movie. It just, they happened to be these two gay guys.
Yeah, they just happened to be two boys, yes. I don't even know if they were gay. They just happened to be two boys.
Who enjoyed having sex in the back of a laundromat. Yeah, well, it inspired me to so much so that when I went to London, I went and did my laundry at a laundromat.
But everybody does. Nothing new. That's where everybody goes because there's nowhere else to go unless you have a washing machine.
I felt like I was taking part in the movie. Then you did Prick Up Your Ears, another amazing film about another gay relationship.
Yes.
With amazing actors, Gary Oldman and Alfred Molina.
Yes.
Playing a real life couple, Joe Orton and Kenneth Halliwell, both the writers of some repute. And that ends very tragically with a murder suicide.
Halliwell murders him.
Yeah. Again, it just was so gritty and real, and it was a window into London's artistic world that really appealed to me.
The truth is, again, it was a brilliant script by Alan Bennett. Nobody knew that this world existed. I sort of knew because I'd worked at the Royal Court Theatre in London, and there were a lot of homosexuals there. So I started to read about this world, and then John Lahr edited Joe Orton's diaries, and you discovered what went on.
And he wrote a play, and the play became the film. Is that correct?
No. John wrote a biography, which included work from the diaries. He may have written a play later on, but he hadn't at the time written a play.
Got it. Okay, I've gotten that completely wrong. But I'm sure it's a great book by John Lahr.
Yes.
Okay, then there was another one, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, another great snapshot of this world.
Yes.
Of this alternate.
I mean, London, you know, there was trouble happening in London at the time. It was quite a rough area. It was quite rough.
But you made it so appealing on camera, that's working class.
That's the wickedness of the camera, yes.
Yeah, so cool. So anyway, you bewitched me from a young age.
I was going to apologize for
leading
you astray.
There's certain films that kind of created my aesthetic, I guess, or my worldview or the things I aspired to. And these were them. They were very important to me. And let it be said, I've been trying to get you on this show for a while now. So I'm very excited. Oh. And now we get to the subject at hand.
I've always known I was born to dominate your sex and avenge my own.
Is there anything I could do to help?
Come back when you've succeeded with Madame de Tourvel.
Yes.
And I will offer you a reward.
My love.
Dangerous Liaisons, yes. 1988. This, I would say, brought you to at least a new level in terms of budget, cast.
It was a huge jump.
So let's start there. How did that jump happen for you? Who had the faith to put all this money in your hands?
Well, it was a very, very successful play. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people tried to buy it. A lot of studios tried to buy it. And in the end, Christopher Hampton, who wrote the play, decided to sell it to a company that existed then called Lorimar Pictures. Mm-hmm. And then they tried to get a director. Unfortunately, at the same time, Milos Forman had announced that he was going to make his version of Dangerous Liaisons. And so a lot of people sort of withdrew because Milos was a very, very formidable figure at the time, very brilliant Czech director. He made two great films in America, Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and then the film of Mozart, Amadeus. Mm-hmm. So he was a very powerful presence and, you know, trailing Oscars. So I think a number of people were slightly put off that. Anyway, eventually it came to my door, because my friend Christopher Hampton said, the person you want is Stephen Frears. And I said, oh, this is terrific. Yeah, no, this is very, very good. So I got the job because I was quicker than me. I said, I'll be fast. I may not be as good as him, but I'm certainly faster than him.
And it's certainly not the first time in Hollywood history where two competing projects on the same topic go head to head. And it often is who's first.
Yes.
But of course, they both have to be good. And as history has proven, yours is the defining version of this story.
Yes. It's quite a sad story. Milos was such a wonderful director. So it's quite sad.
What, did it crush him? Or what?
I think it actually did.
Really?
Well, it was complicated because it was exactly at the same time as the revolution in Prague. So his country was suddenly, from which he'd been exiled, his country was suddenly liberated. But it did rather crush him, as he never made a successful film again.
Did you ever talk to him about the two films?
No, I met him because actually the next film I made, a film called The Grifters.
Amazing movie, by the way.
And I had Annette Bening in it. And Annette had been in Milosz's version of...
Oh, that's right.
Of Valmont. He'd been in his film Valmont. And I actually went to the cutting room and he showed me a bit of Valmont to say, look, this actress is brilliant. So I cast her.
She's in the Glen Coast part?
Yes.
The villainous Marquise de Merteuil. What an amazing part for any actress. And then speaking of other versions, there, of course, Cruel Intentions came along in the 90s.
I never saw it.
You haven't seen it?
I never saw that.
Well, it's a huge cult film for that generation, you know?
Yes.
With the stars of the day and updated to a modern version. But as far as I'm concerned, the definitive one is Dangerous Liaisons.
What dangers await us.
Exactly. And there's danger around every corner in this film.
Yes.
So you were chosen by Christopher Hampton, the screenwriter. And then how does it go from Lorimar to Warner Brothers?
Lorimar was sort of collapsing at the time. I think it was the last film they made and the only film that was successful. And Warner Brothers bought it.
I see.
And at the same time, we were approaching Michelle Pfeiffer to play the Madame de Tourvel in it. And Warner's had a deal with Michelle. So they just sort of took it over. You know, I don't really know much about the way these things are done. But anyway, they took it over, and that was the end of it, really. And then we made it. And no one from Hollywood ever came near the place, never came near us. Well, it was about, men wearing frocks and wigs and things like that. So it wasn't their thing at all. They were rather nervous of it and shy until they eventually saw it. So we were absolutely left alone by Warner Brothers.
Which is a dream for any director, isn't it?
It was absolutely wonderful, yes. Yes. And it was only at the first preview that they started to make demands.
Was it an accident that it was an all-American cast? Was that the studio pushing for that?
No, it was quite deliberate. You know, it began as a play in England. And Alan Rickman and Lindsay Duncan were in it very successfully. But I think everybody wanted to start again, and I wanted to start again. And also, I was slightly nervous about making an English film. In a way... By making it with Americans, I completely changed the ethos of it. In other words, it stopped being a film about social mores and became a film about passion and about feelings. I think it was quite a clever thing to have done. I mean, I did it by accident. I didn't quite realize what I was doing. But afterwards, I thought, oh, I see. That was really what I was pursuing.
Could you explain that a little more? What is it about American?
Well, English actors are very good at playing plays about society. Mm-hmm. And you don't really do that in America. You do work about feelings. So when we turned up with these big American stars, the French, I remember we were filming in Paris, the French got very, very excited by the actors were so powerful, the close-ups were so powerful. So it changed its nature and it stopped being about society and it became about feelings.
Fascinating.
Took me a long time to work.
I don't know if you'd call it a love triangle or a quartet, but very interesting dynamic. So you have, let's talk about the four main actors. A lot of the action is put into play by Glenn Close's character.
Yes.
And tell me a bit about her character and why you chose Glenn.
Well, Glenn, it was really on the back of Fatal Attraction. And she's a very, very powerful actress, very powerful woman and highly intelligent woman. I mean, I can't think of anybody better. It was, to make it with Glenn seemed to me absolutely a blessing from God. She was such a good actress, such a complicated, interesting woman.
Both the actress and the character.
Both the actress and the character, yeah.
You know, she sort of has a monologue in it where she talks about having been...
About pushing the fork into her arm, into her hand to stop herself, really, and to discipline herself.
Yes, and she's been wronged by a past lover.
Yes.
Is she driven by a revenge or a hatred of men? Or what is her deal?
She acquired wisdom through men, really, didn't she? Men taught her the foolishness of men.
Yeah. So to her, life has become sort of a chess game instead of moving with her heart.
Absolutely. And in the end, she destroys the man she loves. So it all ended unhappily.
And speaking of the man she loves, we move on to her foil, the Vicomte de Valmont.
Yeah, brilliant.
Now, I know there was some controversy because you cast John Malkovich, who perhaps is not considered, you know, the Lothario of the silver screen.
Yes, but of course he's an incredible actor. I mean, he does it all by acting rather than resting on his good looks. He was in a play in New York at the time called Burn This,
mm-hmm.
and quite exceptionally powerful. I mean, I watched a bit of the film the other day. He's just dazzling, dazzling.
So it was your idea?
No, it wasn't my idea. He wanted to do it, and it was really getting me to agree to it. And I went to New York and saw the play and could see how extraordinary it was. I could never think of anybody better.
Did Alan Rickman say, hey, you know, I kind of made a hit of this?
No, Lorimar said, look, we'd rather start again, which I entirely agreed with. Mm-hmm. So Alan didn't say, hey. Alan, whom I knew and knew quite well, he was very gracious about it.
I'm sure. I would have loved to have seen him in it. He would have been wonderful. But yeah,
I never saw it. Do I mean that? Perhaps I did see him in it.
And rounding out this quartet is this very naive, gorgeous ingenue, fresh out of the convent, Cécile de Volanges, played by the gorgeous Uma Thurman at a very young age.
Yes, she was very young, 16 going on 40. She was so mysterious. John was very good. John really looked after her, and she was wonderful. You know, some days when you make films, everything just works. And in that film, everything worked. It could all have gone horribly wrong, but it chose not to.
How did you find Uma?
I mean, they all kept saying, oh, the person you want is Uma. I don't know. Maybe she was well known or known in those circles in New York. We never saw anybody else, I don't think.
Isn't that amazing?
Mm.
And then there is a fifth character, the Chevalier Raphael Danceny, a very handsome young music teacher who Uma's character falls for, but he's not aristocratic. Yeah. And that character is played by Keanu Reeves, looking, yes, I don't know, 18 maybe?
Well, it was the start of his career. By the time we opened that film called Excellent Adventures, Bill and Ted, that had opened, it became a big star. But when we shot the film, he hadn't. And, I saw a lot of young actors and said I liked him. Christopher Hampton actually thought I'd gone mad. And I said, no, he's the one. But I remember when he came to Paris and looked completely lost, Michel saying, no, he'll be a big star. And they all took a big shine to him, the girls.
Michelle Pfeiffer called it. She said he's going to be a big star.
She said he'll be a big star.
Isn't that funny? Because, what I remember now, everyone considers him, you know, royalty. But at the time, early in his career, I remember when he was in Dracula, in this, that the Bill character overshadowed it all. And people assumed he was kind of an airhead and couldn't act.
Yeah.
Like surfer intonation.
Yes.
Which he does bring a bit to this character, but it works.
Yes. I can't honestly remember why I cast him, but he seemed he was the best person I saw. You know, in the end, you have to believe in things. And he made it all believable. You know, in other words, you could see that Glenn would want to go to bed with him and people would fall in love with him. He was a sweet boy.
Very sweet.
I once stood beside him outside Book Soup and I thought, oh, everything's going to be all right. I'm standing beside the most beautiful chap in the world.
I like that story. We should all be so lucky. Mm. So these are the five characters, really, and it's a complicated plot.
Yeah, really revolve around each other.
Yeah.
Very brilliant plot. And Christopher Hampton had written this brilliant play from it, which became a sort of world success. The actors were initially rather nervous, and then they started to get a taste for it, and then it became irresistible, and it was like a sort of engine. It just drove everything through. The jokes were so funny.
It's funny. It's dirty.
So exciting, yes. Someone in Toronto said, oh, it's like eating chocolate in bed.
Yes, it is. Mm. And you can see why it was such a hit, because who wants to see people behaving nicely when you could see them?
No. I knew that the worse they behaved, the more popular. You had finally found a film in which people were encouraged to behave badly. Very, very satisfying.
But the key is that as hard and jaded as they try to come off, they both have Achilles' heels. Yeah, John Malkovich falls for Michelle.
John fell in love, yeah.
And you're saying Glenn Close's character is always in love with John Malkovich. That's what is driving
her. At the end, when she sort of goes bananas at the end, it's because she's killed the man she loves.
At the end, the two, bad guys, Glenn and John, declare war on each other.
Yes.
It's such an amazing scene.
Shall we go up?
What?
Go up. Unless you prefer this, if memory serves, rather purgatorial sofa.
I think it's time you were leaving.
No, I don't think so. We made an arrangement. I really don't think I can allow myself to be taken advantage of for a moment longer.
Remember, I'm better at this than you are.
Perhaps, but it is always the best swimmers who drown. Now, yes or no? It's up to you, of course. I will merely confine myself to remarking that a no will be regarded as a declaration of war. A single word is all that's required.
All right. War.
I'm wondering, what is going on there exactly? She's withholding herself from him. They had made a deal that she was going to have sex with him if he did X, Y, Z, which he did.
She avoids it. She finds reasons not to do it, not to have sex with him. You know, so love and hate are very close, aren't they? So there's a wonderful moment when she declares war on him. And then there's a duel. Oh, it's everything that one could wish for in a story.
But what is going on in his head? Because he's in love with Michelle Pfeiffer already. But yet he kind of like throws it all away to like get Glenn Close to close the deal.
He can't work out what he wants. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
He keeps taunting him. Yeah. Then he treats Michelle very, very badly.
Yes.
And whereupon she dies. And the truth is she dies. How this got through Warner Brothers, I've no idea. She dies out of love. You know, it's love that kills her. You know,
broken heart. It,
I mean, that wouldn't go down very well at a pitch meeting. But anyway, that's why she dies. And it's quite peculiar in the book as well as the film. So she dies of love.
Well, because she's the one with all these sort of higher ideals that he wants to sort of...
She's a Christian woman.
Yeah. But he finally gets through.
He really wants to degrade her and humiliate her. And then he falls in love with him. So it's a real mess.
But so captivating. And then, so Uma's character, there's a... I've seen it written that it's a rape scene or just a seduction scene. What was your take on it?
Well, at the time, I thought it was a seduction scene. I remember a woman in Ireland saying to me, well, it's rape. And I tried to deny it. But the more I think about it, the more I think, yes, no, it does seem to me it was a rape. It was, he raped her. But she was so willing to be raped. I don't know what that does to the whole thing. But we got away with it. And nobody, at the time when we were making it, nobody ever questioned that. That was just what happened. And I say it was under this word seduction. But if you look at it through modern eyes, it was rape. Yeah, shocking. And I didn't know better than to. I wasn't worldly enough to question it. And John did it with great grace. And I say Uma never complained. So we all just got on with it.
I had read somewhere that later on, as she got older, she complained that she felt she was too naked in the film, in that scene.
Yes, but she would have reason to.
Yeah, it probably would have been accomplished very differently in today's climate.
Yes, you'd be more sensitive to it.
How have you adjusted to the change in how these things are done on sets with intimacy coordinators and all that?
I cannot believe all that. I mean, I'm completely gobsmacked. The truth is, at the time, Uma wasn't remotely hurt. She may well have looked back and thought, I shouldn't have gone along with that. But at the time, nobody was suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I don't ever have a sense of anybody suffering in any film I've made. So I don't quite know what... I mean, it seems to me the more people involved, the more painful it gets. Mm-hmm. And someone reminding you that you're being violated in some way can't make matters better.
And then, of course, for the most iconic scene to me, the one that I first think of when I think of the film, is the last two shots, you know, the opera house.
Oh, Glenn taking her makeup off.
Yes. So basically she gets her comeuppance at the end of the film.
Yes.
These letters have been circulated through Paris and you see all the dastardly.
In the book it says about her face somehow became ravaged and disfigured. And she was disfigured in some way. Anyway.
She gets some kind of disease in the book.
Yes, that's right.
A sexual disease.
Yeah, but anyway, we ended with her taking off her makeup because we'd begun with her putting on her makeup. And the other day, and all I knew was that they said, look, if you want a second take, it'll take 2 hours to get
put all the makeup back on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, my God. And she said to me a couple of years ago, oh, I'd have loved a second take at that. I thought, oh, that would have destroyed everything.
Well, the take is so perfect, she cries.
Yes. And even that I remember. Because Philip Rousselot, the cameraman, said, let's fade the lights on the day. In other words, instead of going to the laboratory and having the laboratory taking the fade down. And so he stood there like an usherette in the cinema, fading the lights. I said, all right, I'll give you a cue. So I gave him the cue. And just at that moment, a tear started to come down Glenn's cheek. So we had to bring them up again.
But the final blackout in the film is a literal
Literally,
blackout?
Literally, the lights off. We turn the lights down, yes.
I love that. And then what about the opera scene?
Ooh, 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 ooh.
First of all, I love that the French boo is just an ooh.
Yes, they told me how they did that. Oh, all right, well, we'll do that. Then Glenn does that stumble, doesn't she?
Yeah, she walks out and she kind of like buckles under one. I'm just curious, you know, to have that many people in a scene dressed in period, late 18th century garb. I mean, it's quite an undertaking, I imagine.
I can't remember. I mean, other people, I don't do it. That's what it said, you know, the theater is full. So I guess they dressed them.
But there was a real kind of interesting, the way the whole crowd turns on her versus just a couple people, one person, then a couple.
That was what we were trying to do, was to have people turning on her.
So are you talking to them through a bullhorn? I'm curious how you direct a scene like that.
I can't remember. You just say, and then they do it. And then you say, well, why don't you do it like this way? Do you go first and you go second, whatever it is. I can't remember the mechanics of it, but it's quite straightforward.
Yeah, when I see it, I'm like, you're a genius. You've directed, you know, hundreds of people.
Well, that's just, but when you look at really great crowd scenes, you know, they're fantastic. I can't do that. Or I've never had to learn to do it because I've never had those sort of size budgets. I mean, it's only money. If you have a lot of money, you can afford a lot of extras.
Well, no wonder people love money so much.
But I never got to those sort of heights of money.
So the film is a jewel. It goes on to, first of all, success at the box office. Probably more success than you've ever seen in your career until this point.
The whole thing was a whole new world to me.
And then is Hollywood treating you differently? Or what happens after a film like that?
Well, curious enough, before it had happened, Martin Scorsese had asked me to do The Grifters, which was very, very interesting. And then they asked me to do Liaison. And we found Donald Westlake to write the script of The Grifters. And then there was a strike. There was a writer's strike. So Donald couldn't write the script.
La plus ça change.
Yes. So I was doing nothing. So I said, all right, well, now we'll do Dangerous Liaisons. And then when we finished Dangerous Liaisons, I said, well, now let's make The Grifters. And I suppose The Grifters was much cheaper, I think. I went down rather than up. Except The Grifters was an interesting project.
Oh, we could do a whole episode on The Grifters. I love that movie.
Yes.
The oranges. Oh, my goodness.
You ever hear about the oranges, Lily?
You mean the insurance, Framus?
Tell me about the oranges, Lily. How do you put those in the towel?
Is it true the oranges in the original script, she was supposed to get beaten with the oranges?
No, he hit her. He threatened her. And somewhere it says about what the effect of the oranges are. But that scene originally took place in the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Hmm.
And we shot it in Pasadena somewhere. But it originally was written, Jim Thompson set it in the Beverly Hills Hotel, which always made me laugh.
I had heard a story somewhere that in the script she does get beaten.
No, it was just the threat was so frightening.
Okay. It's so scary. I never looked at an orange the same way.
Yes.
But back to Dangerous Liaison. So it gets nominated for many Academy Awards.
Seven. We got three nominations.
That's just amazing. I mean, what a thrill for you. Or do you not get impressed by that kind of thing?
No, I was I couldn't believe it. It was so fantastic. It was the first time I'd been in real Hollywood. It was very, very interesting. And there was so much to learn.
Well, these are the stories I love. What did you learn in Hollywood?
I remember having dinner in London with Alan Parker and Barry Levinson. Mm-hmm. Barry had made Rain Man and Alan had made Mississippi Burning. And we had 23 nominations between us. Mm. When I went to Hollywood, after the Governor's Ball, and I could see that there were these people, there were the actors, and then there were the executives from the studios. And then there was a little seam of people, and the directors were these rather plain people who could go between. They could speak to the actors and they could speak to the studio. And I thought, I see, I'm like someone like Alan. I'm like one of those people. And that was rather interesting.
You found your tribe.
In a way, yes. Yes.
Had you heard any horror stories? Like, don't work with this person?
Oh, yes. I mean, I read the same books that everybody else reads. I had the same preconceptions.
And the film, like we said, won 3 Academy Awards. It won Adapted Screenplay.
Yes, Christopher won. Yes.
And art direction and costumes.
I mean, the art director, Stuart Craig, who is brilliant, he had no budget. There was scarcely a budget. And he did it all with so little. And it looked so lavish. So it was terrific when he won it and when Jim Acheson won it with the costume. Jim had won the previous year with Bertolucci. I think it was the Chinese one, The Last Emperor.
Oh, The Last Emperor. Wow.
So I suddenly had this crew of really brilliant people.
You were filming in the actual castles, right?
No. We filmed in Paris. We originally went to Budapest because someone said you could do Paris in Budapest, but that turned out to be nonsense. Then we've actually shot it in Paris. We had nowhere very classy. All the good chateaux were full of Japanese tourists who'd booked the day. Anyway, we ended up these places. I remember Stuart Craig coming to me and saying, this is how you make it. You shoot this there and that there, and I'll build you a bit here, and I'll do this and I'll do that. So we picked our way through what we could get.
I have to ask, because I saw this somewhere, is it true that John Malkovich and Michelle Pfeiffer had an affair during the making?
They fell in love, yes.
Wow. Did you see that happen? Not the actual, affair, but, the love?
Yes.
And
yes.
How does that affect the filming?
Since the film was about John Malkovich's character falling in love with Michelle's character, I guess it's good for the grosses, but isn't that what they call good chemistry?
Sure. And, it had to make it feel realer on camera, I assume, since yes. They were in love.
And she had this extraordinary period when she suddenly blossomed and made Marriage of the Mob, Liaison, and Fabulous Baker Boy. She had this wonderful couple of years.
Yeah, and so different, each of those roles. Yes. Wow, that's okay. It's true. And what a couple, but it didn't last.
It lasted for the filming.
Any other set gossip you could share with us?
No, you have to prize it out of me.
Well, I would think, Uma and Keanu would make a cute couple.
Well, you must speak to them.
All right, I'll stop digging. And so what did you take away from this? I mean, I know you went straight into Grifters, but what lessons did you learn from this?
I thought I would be a very good studio director because I so enjoyed directing the actors in Liaison and they were so good. And I thought, oh, that's what I'd be. I could be someone like Sidney Pollack, who was very good at those sort of films. But then it turned out that I couldn't be like that. So I began to learn the lessons I eventually learned from Hollywood. I mean, Hollywood is the most interesting place I've ever been in my life. It was fantastic. Liaison, you look back and you think, oh, well, I can see we were very, very lucky. It shouldn't really have been made, the film, but it got made and was successful, as you say. That's a sort of enchanted life. Not all films were enchanted in that way.
It's interesting that you bring up Sidney Pollack as this example of someone who can work within the Hollywood system, but make these incredibly artistic and fulfilling films. But I see that you as that as well. So what was dissonant with Hollywood? What wasn't working?
I couldn't do that. When I eventually made studio films, I found them very confusing and rather public affairs, and I wasn't able to do them. I don't know why. My talent got as far as there and didn't get to the next stage.
Well, maybe it has something to do with the fact that they got too involved, in this one they weren't involved at all.
Maybe.
And you need to have sort of 100% control over these things.
Well, it wasn't so much control. Christopher Hampton is a friend of mine. I understood the jokes. I thought these characters were wonderful. I thought I could make a really good film. So I was feeling very at ease when I made it.
Of course, you went on to make some incredible films, maybe not what you could consider Hollywood blockbuster film, but films that changed the game.
Largely back in England, yes.
Maybe, although High Fidelity was American.
Yes, but I remember Joe Roth saying to me, make it like an independent film. And afterwards I thought, what a generous thing to say. What a clever thing to say.
But the one I really want to talk about is The Queen from 2006.
Yeah.
Which amazingly successful, wonderful film, but a radical film in that it was dramatizing the current royal family in a way that hadn't been done before.
Yeah.
And of course, now it's been done ad nauseum with The Crown.
That was really... We made a film about Tony Blair, and then they said, would you like to make a second film about the events of Diana's death and with the Queen as a character? It was really Peter Morgan who said the really interesting character is the Queen.
Mm.
He said it quite specifically. They wanted him to write a film about Diana's death, but he came back and said the interesting character is the Queen. Well, that seems to me a very, very clever thing to have said.
Sure, but also a bit of a taboo to tackle, the Queen as being her shortcomings.
It was the worst week of the Queen's reign, but there was nothing in it that was controversial or shocking. I could see the idea of making a film about her was shocking, and now every film is about her, so I apologize. But there was nothing shocking in the film.
From my point of view, I knew the story of Diana, but it had never really been in my face that way. Why is she withholding sympathy for this woman's death?
Well,
what's going on?
Peter's originality.
Mm-hmm.
that was, you know, you have to give the credit to Peter. He did all that.
Wow.
And he said, the Queen is the interesting character.
And then, of course, he went on to make The Crown. And
yes, to earn millions. I can't bear it. I'm so jealous.
What do you make of the royal family now? Not to put you on the spot, but I can't keep up with it all.
Well, I could see the Queen clearly was a rather remarkable woman. We all thought she was like our mothers because that's how we were brought up. This woman who was rather dutiful and self-sacrificing. Who knows what she was like? And when she died, you thought, oh, I see, actually it is rather striking and I doubt if anyone will quite measure up to her again.
Yeah, I got emotional. I grew up in Canada, so, you know, I had her since I was a baby.
I don't think I got emotional. I just thought, well, she was remarkable.
Yeah. Well, good luck to the rest of them.
Just don't involve me.
I don't know. Maybe it's time to go back to that well. You were so good at it. Ever again. What are you working on next, besides the research?
Well, I'm trying to sort out. I don't quite know, is the answer. Next year, I'm supposed to make a film about Billy Wilder.
Oh, wow. That would be wonderful.
Yes. No. At the end of his life. So quite a sad film. But he made such wonderful films and clearly was an extraordinary man.
Yeah. He escaped Nazi Germany, really. I think
he did escape Nazi Germany, yes.
I read his mother wanted to stay in Austria and perished. His mother. He tried to.
His mother stayed. No, his mother stayed and he died in a camp.
Yeah, it's so tragic.
Yes.
So I would love to see that. Who would you cast?
Christoph Waltz is going to play him.
Oh, wow. Okay. I already have my ticket prepaid. I have my ticket ready for that one. One of my first jobs, I worked at Vanity Fair as an intern. They had me send out the Hollywood issue to various people that were in it. And so I had a list, and one said Billy Wilder and an address and a phone number. And I was like, could it be? And I called him up, and it was him.
So you spoke to him?
Yeah.
I'm sure he was perfectly civil.
Oh, he was awesome. I could not believe I was talking to him. I was sort of like,
I met him once.
Definitely overdue for a film about him. All right, Mr. Frears, this is so incredible. Thank you so much for joining us on It Happened in Hollywood.
Well, thank you, Stephen Frears. Like I told you, and how exciting to be able to tell you, you are one of my favorite directors. So that was really a thrill. Next week, we have something really special. It's been 50 years since The Sting won Best Picture at the Academy Awards. Hopefully you watched this week and you saw Oppenheimer take the big prize, but go backwards in time. And this amazing movie about a grand scam starring Paul Newman and Robert Redford won the top award in addition to a number of other Oscars. It was a huge box office hit, and it was made by a producing pair who are joining us, Michael Phillips and Tony Bill. And we are also joined by David S. Ward, the screenwriter. This was his first outing, and he was one of those Academy Award winners. So we have the trio of men with us reliving their Academy Awards highs and the making of this indelible classic, The Sting. So we'll see you next week. And until then, I'll see you in Hollywood.